Hello everyone, greetings from the Bahamas. It's a real honour to be presenting this Oliver Barclay lecture today, and I really am grateful for this opportunity. In this lecture, I want to revisit the theme of the 2015 Southern Conference on the problem of suffering in the world, how I think science can inform the issue, and in particular, the importance of our evolutionary connection to the rest of the world. But before that, I'd like to begin by mentioning the person for whom this lecture is named. Although we never met, Oliver Barclay was a biologist like myself, and I was pleased to read of his particular enthusiasm for marine biological fieldwork. I wanted to start with these quotes from Oliver that I found encouraging. Sometimes coming to conferences can be intimidating for new members of CIS. With the ever-growing number of people working on science faith issues, often in a professional capacity, some may be left thinking, what can I contribute that is new or interesting? I would say that's not necessarily our job. What is imperative is that CIS members are constantly tackling afresh issues of science and faith, as Oliver said, and that we're getting out there and discussing important issues with our friends and in congregations, even if we're not leading experts on a particular topic. I believe that there's a real potential for CIS members to have a great positive impact on popular culture by helping bring issues of science and faith to the fore, seeking out opportunities to show the fruitfulness of a complementary approach. And on that note, I'd like to start not with science or the Bible, but with popular culture. In 2011, a film called Tree of Life won the Palme d'Or for writer-director Terrence Malick at the Cannes Film Festival. The film's plot focuses on the childhood of Jack O'Brien in 1950s America, a complicated family dynamic, and the enduring fallout of the tragic death of his teenage brother. The film opens with a grieving mother who has just received news of her son's death. After 20 minutes of empathizing with the parents as they work through this event, Malick does something that the film critic Peter Bradshaw describes as extraordinary and gobsmacking, requiring unbelievable daring and confidence from the filmmaker. The film cuts to pitch black silence, and then a flickering flame appears. And for the next 17 minutes, we are then taken on a visually stunning extended meditation on the formation of the universe, of the planets, and the evolution of life on Earth. Unfortunately, the whole clip would take up the entirety of my talk. At the beginning of the sequence, we hear whispering questions in the film. Lord, why? Where were you? Who are we to you? Answer me. What are we to make of this? Taking their cue from this quotation that appears at the start of the film, many critics vaguely understood that it's a reference to God, spirituality, and the nature of the universe. But most of these mainstream commentators seem to have missed exactly what Malick was doing here. To the Christian viewer, it's clear that he's echoing the ancient story of Job, of God's cosmic answer to Job's suffering. But he's doing more than that. The film tries, I believe, to capture an accurate, scientifically informed portrait of how we have all come to be here, albeit with some artistic license. Malick is trying to mimic the sense of awe and wonder that ancient audiences would have experienced at the telling of the Job story, but for a modern, scientifically informed public. But what does the story of Job have to offer to the modern reader, and especially the modern scientist? Many of the rhetorical questions that form God's climactic response to Job can actually be answered with a resounding yes now. As a marine biologist who studies the deepest parts of our ocean, I can say that we as humans certainly have entered into the springs of the deep and walked in the recesses of the deep, bringing to mind the discovery of hydrothermal vents by humans descending in the submersible Alvin. John Polkinghorne makes the same point, that a modern-day Job spoken to out of the whirlwind could be pointed to phenomena very much more impressive even than the wild ox and the ostrich. While somewhat flippant, the point is important. We are no longer as ignorant of the workings of nature as we once were. In the 3 millennia since the Job story originated, humanity has accumulated substantial knowledge of the world around us and its workings through the processes now regarded as scientific inquiry. Of course, there is still much to learn, but there is much achievement to acknowledge as well, and I feel that Christians sometimes forget this. I stress this point because God's accusation against Job specifically revolves around his ignorance. Who is this that darkens my counsel without knowledge? In other words, God seems to be suggesting that Job doesn't know what he's talking about. The wider point of God's riposte seems to be that Job is only one part of creation, and a rather impotent one at that. And the danger is that readers leave with only this part of the story's message. The resoundingly positive truth that I take from reading the book of Job is that an answer to our suffering can be found in our relationship to the rest of the created order and our place within it. In this way, science offers a pivotal perspective on the human condition, and I think this is what Malick was doing in the film as well. I must emphasize here that I'm not trying to put forth some science-based theodicy. I don't think that's possible or permissible. I do, however, think that it is legitimate to ask how scientific knowledge changes our perspective on why bad things happen. And here's a few examples of where I think science forces us to reframe why questions. Let's start with a big one, death. As a marine ecologist, much of my research has in one way or another related to the processes that generate life from death in the oceans. There's no better metaphor for this than the topic of my doctoral research, the phenomenon of a whale fall. In the deep ocean, the arrival of a dead whale carcass on the seabed is a food bonanza in a nutritional desert. This manna from above brings forth an oasis of strange and abundant life. On evolutionary timescales, these regular food fall events have led to the radiation of whole new forms of life dependent on the death of these ocean giants. Death brings forth life. From a biological perspective, death itself is an inevitable part of being a living animal. Indeed, the science writer Nick Lane pithily points out that only death makes multicellular life possible. Without death, we or anything capable of intimate relationship with a personal God could not be here. The inevitability of death is a central theme of the book of Ecclesiastes, where the skeptical Kohelet rails against any sense of natural justice in the world. I said in my heart with regards to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. His overriding view of human suffering is that humans are essentially animals. We're not elevated to the point that we can escape the pains and gripes of the world. The imagery is firmly rooted in the account of Genesis 2, humans and animals created from the same earth and have the same breath of God that animates us. We suffer the same ills and both return to the dust from when we came. It's clear from the passage as a whole that there is no room for human hubris that gives us a special exemption pass from death and suffering. Evolution confirms what this wisdom literature has long known. On another front, our evolutionary connection to all other life on Earth provides a fresh lens through which we can understand disease. The field of so-called evolutionary medicine is concerned with the ultimate why questions of human disease. Instead of asking, why does this person have this disease, it asks, why are human beings even susceptible to this disease? Evolution offers ultimate rather than proximate explanations. In their seminal book for popular audiences, Why We Get Sick, Nessie and Williams, a physician and evolutionary biologist respectively, propose six categories of evolutionary explanation for the existence of any particular disease, which can be grouped as follows. The first two relate to the speed at which natural selection can act. Firstly, our bodies are mismatched to modern environments. We evolved as hunter-gatherers, leading to a whole host of lifestyle diseases. Secondly, our bodies are being attacked by other living organisms that evolve faster than we can, resulting in a continual evolutionary arms race between us and those organisms that infect us. The next two explanations of disease result from the limits of natural selection itself. There are flaws in our body that are the legacy of previous evolutionary adaptations. The classic one is the inverted retina layout in our eye. Evolution can only work with the previous building blocks provided. Also, harmful genotypes and phenotypes may persist in humans because they provide net benefits despite a very large cost. There may also be some misunderstanding as to what exactly natural selection works on. Genes persist if they increase reproduction, regardless of an expense on long-term health. So genes that may lead to poor health later in life may still persist in a population if they lead to increased reproduction. And finally, we may actually mistake defensive mechanisms for disease itself, like coughing or fever. Many diseases actually result from a combination of these explanations. Take the recent example of the ApoE gene. Carriers of the E4 allele have a 3 times greater risk of developing Alzheimer's. That increases to 8 to 12 times higher if carrying 2 copies. Why does this allele still exist in human populations if it's so deleterious? A recent study gives us a clue. When researchers examined populations of the Samani people of Bolivia with high parasite levels, they saw that the E4 carriers actually had better mental skills, even outperforming E3 carriers who were parasite-free. For most of our history, humans had to cope with parasites galore, and perhaps the E4 variant helped our ancestors to cope with that burden, as it seems to do in today's Samani. Cancer is another area where an evolutionary approach can change the way we look at things. When we consider the why of cancer, we normally consider the genetic and environmental factors that contribute to the risk of cancer for an individual. However, in 2015, a controversial paper in the journal Science suggested that the majority of different types of cancer, not the number of occurrences, were, and I quote, due to bad luck. That is, random mutations arising during DNA replication in normal non-cancerous stem cells. The authors summarize, replicative mutations are unavoidable. They are, in a sense, a side effect of evolution, which cannot proceed without them. With a hindsight of evolutionary theory, John Polkinghorne suggests that cancer is not something gratuitous that a creator who was more competent or more compassionate could readily have eliminated. It is the shadow side of a world in which creatures are allowed to make themselves. As part of the Abrahamic monotheistic tradition, we're faced with a paradox between God's allowance of suffering through the orderly unfolding of the universe on one hand, even as he cares for and suffers with the individual. In Psalm 8, after considering the grandeur and majesty of God's creation, the psalmist feels compelled to question the significance of humankind. I think that many hearers of the Job story, or indeed of a modern scientific account of why we suffer bad things, can be left with a sense of cosmic indifference towards humanity. But this is where Christianity has something to offer. The author of Hebrews picks up this part of Psalm 8 in their extended portrayal of Jesus as a fellow human sufferer. He is a son of man. Here is the ultimate revelation of a relational God, not a distant deist God. These verses in Hebrews provide a fitting conclusion. In science, we see God as the universal creator and orderly sustainer of the world. But in Jesus, we see the embodiment of God's love for us. As Christians in science, we are in a unique position to help fellow Christians understand the ways of God through science, and to show others the loving grace of God evidenced in the way of Jesus. Thank you all very much.